Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email and also via telephone. I'll be giving out those numbers in just a few moments. But before I do so, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let's take just a few moments and talk about cerebral palsy. There was something that got that into my mind this morning, and a typical story that promotes the kind of mythology that everyone knows, that cerebral palsy is caused by the doctor making a mistake at birth, right? Actually, 90% of cases of cerebral palsy have nothing to do with birth trauma. The damage that occurs during birth trauma and during fetal asphyxia, actually, at birth, is primarily to the cognitive part of the brain. In other words, you will get mental slowing from birth trauma anoxia, the type of damage that occurs in the motor cortex that is characteristic of spastic cerebral palsy, is 90% of the time occurs well before birth, and in fact often triggers prematurity. 50% of children with cerebral palsy are born premature. It's not the prematurity that causes the cerebral palsy. It is in fact the cerebral palsy that causes the maturity. So just kind of wanted to put out there one of those everybody knows facts that's actually kind of wrong. And one of the reasons, you might say, that we have a problem in this country with access to both family planning services and, for that matter, obstetrical services, is the blame the doctor scenario when a baby is born with a problem. That blame the doctor scenario leads to extraordinarily high malpractice suits that leads to very, very high insurance rates, and those insurance rates get passed through. And certain legislation, we talked last week about, or a couple weeks ago actually now, about Prop 46, which is one that I'm really worried about because it will essentially drive the malpractice rates to the point that you'll have to work for an institution. Practices simply will not be able to sustain it, particularly obstetrical practices, which are already kind of on the ropes from, $100,000 a year insurance premium, does kind of make it hard to serve the poor. So, of course, it all happens through to institutions because they can get either federal funding or otherwise do it. But if you don't have a Planned Parenthood or a Women's Health Center, we're very fortunate in this community to have both. And we are very fortunate. There are smaller communities that have neither, and women have to travel a long way for access to any kind of gynecological or obstetric services. Some of that's driven by the way that we pay people for taking care of damaged infants. And however an infant is damaged, whether it is an act of God, a bolt of lightning, or an error medically, the reimbursement and support that that infant receives should be the same. It shouldn't be some kind of lottery. It should be a right to education, to appropriate rehabilitative services, and to appropriate family support. That's what a civilized society does. The circumstances of the injury should not affect the support that society gives the infant. So we are now going to turn the conversation to something I'm sure that's a little bit more on the front of everybody else's mind right now, which is Ebola. And as I walked around the community this week, I got so many questions about, what do you think about this, Dr. Don? What do you think about, should we be worried about Ebola? And it was, of course, a very big topic again in the news this week. So I want to reiterate, I don't see Ebola as a serious danger to us here in the United States. If anything, I think it's kind of a blessing in disguise. If it moves us, if it makes us move, if it makes us think, if it makes us act, it's a dress rehearsal for the potential that is always lurking out there of a major epidemic. And one of the things that came out this week in the news was the National Nursing Survey, which showed an appalling 83% of responding nurses. Now, this is not a scientific survey. Okay, this was people who responded, but 82% of the people who responded said, no, we have not received any training. We have not received extra education on how to take off the protective gear. And in many cases, we don't know where the protective gear is. Well, I want to give a shout out to our local Dominican hospital that I think that I want to say has been extremely proactive in this regard. And I have been receiving memos and letters from them, including a very, very good graphic about reminding us all how to take off the protective gear properly and what to do if you're accidentally contaminated in the process of taking off the protective gear. It's not to say that it isn't a massive problem. Just think about disposing bags and bags of potentially contaminated protective gear, even from nurses going in and out of one room of a person with an infectious disease like Ebola. But I want to point out that you can do something to help. Those of you who are podcast listeners, those of you who are in other areas, write or email the public health officer or the public information officer, excuse me, of your local hospital and simply ask if you could see a copy of the Ebola readiness information that's been given to the staff. You could frame it as, you know, I saw that nurse's survey and I want to be, I before I come to your hospital, I want to be sure that the staff have what they need and are protected. So could I see what you're giving out to the staff in the way of information? Now, don't pester them if you don't get a reply. That's really not the point of this. The point is, and you're going to say that you're watching and you're going to say that it matters. And that's how you set priorities in a bureaucratic system, is you open the windows and take a flashlight. So if there are hospitals out there that are stalling or hospitals who think that it's okay not to have protective gear, that is hard for me, actually. It's hard for me to credit because it's so obvious to any administrator that if your staff gets sick, you're in trouble, that I just don't believe. Well, I don't know. There are people who think the earth is flat. I hope none of them are running hospitals. But for the most part, I think that this is not a credible assertion. I think it's union politics a little bit. But the broader issue here is that as a society, we need a rational quarantine and containment policy. I mentioned this a little bit last week, but I want to amplify on the issue. So let's have a few epidemic facts, okay? There are models of geometric progression. You can look online and, you know, search disease progression models, go to scholar.google and do that, and you'll get lots of review articles discussing the finer nuances of these models. But essentially, it's geometric progression, right? I sneeze on you, I sneeze on three people, three people sneeze on three people, those three people sneeze on three people, and, you know, we're up to 96 people or something that have been exposed. And that can happen fairly rapidly. So when you're talking about a particular disease, there are a number of factors that figure into what this amplification looks like. One of them is incubation. And viruses vary a great deal in terms of their incubation. Another is the duration of infectiousness before symptoms or the latency period. And in Ebola, this is very key. The third variable, one that is often not thought of but is very important, is the speed to incapacity. In other words, how fast do you get so sick that people start avoiding you because you're clearly infectious? And also, before you stop moving around and are able to transmit a virus. And In case of, let's say, norovirus, this is the virus that causes Norwalk agent, which causes a vomiting and diarrhea disease, the cruise ship illness. Norovirus is very contagious. The latency period is only 1 to 2 days. It persists on surfaces for a very long time, but essentially it has no latency period. About the time, you're not infectious at all until you're sick. You get sick very fast and you're infectious once you're sick. Flu virus, pretty much the same thing. Not much of a latency period. Incubation's 1 to 2 days. Very good. So you can figure out who's sick. And by the time they're infectious, they're already sick. Sneezing, coughing, pretty clear something's going on. Ebola, well, 2 to 20 days incubation period. That's a problem. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. But a long incubation period makes it very difficult to contain a virus. Latency with Ebola, so far we think we've got ample evidence, I might add, that you have to be sick before you're infectious. You have to be febrile. You have to have symptoms. That's good. Rabies? Well, rabies is 1 to 3 months. And essentially, you're not contagious until you're symptomatic, which is also good. But symptoms early on in rabies are things like a headache and some light sensitivity. Hard to differentiate that from a case of viral meningitis. HIV? Well, 2 to 3 weeks before you're infectious, but you're not sick for a very long time. So people can be contagious and not sick for years. And that's been, well, we all know what happened with HIV and how that beast was alive and transmitted for literally decades by individuals until they became ill enough to be identified. And that is a big problem for that disease that we're still chasing. So obviously a long latency disease presents a really big problem for quarantine. Quarantines, you know, go back to the 1350s. The first use of the word was then in Venice because it was during the Black Death, and ships that arrived at the port of Venice were required to sit at anchor for 40 days, the quarantino, before they could be allowed to enter the city of Venice. Obviously, the rats didn't pay any attention and climbed down the ropes, so the quarantine didn't really work. But the concept of containing people who are traveling from an area where there's known disease first historically dates back to that time. Now, what if we were to try, as some of the right-wing radio station commentators have promoted, what if we were to try to quarantine Africa or West Africa or people traveling from West Africa? I mean, let's think that through for just a moment. It easily becomes impractical if the moment that you really think it through. There's really two options. You can take everyone getting off the plane from Liberia and you can put them in the soccer stadium, and then you can keep throwing more and more people into the soccer stadium until you have a Katrina disaster situation, which I think would not be anything that anyone would seriously attempt to do on purpose, I might say. You could say, all right, we're going to take over all of the airport hotels, and everybody who comes off a plane from an area where there's potentially Ebola, we'll put you in a hotel room and feed you room service for 21 days. Well, it doesn't take much. That's why I talked about geometric progression at the morning. First of all, what do you think the hotel staff are going to say about cleaning those rooms or bringing the room service? I think you're going to have a little problem there. These are not people who've dedicated their lives to doing healthcare. These are people who are working at a motel or a hotel. Why should they be obligated to risk their lives? So you got a problem with quarantining large numbers of the population if you do it unethically or if you do it ethically. And of course, the unethical rationale, if you put a whole bunch of people in a room and only one has Ebola, how long before they all have Ebola? Well, 21 days maybe. This is not something that we can treat at the quarantine level. This is something that we have to treat at the source, that's where the resources need to go. That's where the protective garments need to go. And we need to quarantine those few individuals who get sick in this country and put, you know, on essentially house arrest or house guard those who are exposed to them. And we, when I say house guard, I'm not talking about locking someone up in their house. Unless, of course, they get a fever. But I do think monitoring, having people do just purely voluntary monitoring may be an error. I don't quite know how it's being done. If anyone knows how it's being done there in Texas to those 100 people who were exposed to our index case, I'd love to know. So give me a call if you have that information. Otherwise, if you have a perspective or thought about Ebola and what's going on or anything else I've discussed so far, I'd love to hear from you at 476-2800. That's 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. Once again, 1-800-655-5877. What about the idea of another virus? What about a superflu? What about a SARS epidemic? What about H1N1? What about? Fill in the blank. Well, in an actual circumstance where a short latency, highly contagious respiratory illness manifested, your move is to go to your earthquake kit. Now, hopefully, and anyone who lives in Northern California, I hope, has a independent water supply that it is good for at least a week. Hopefully a food supply that'll last you at least a week, and more would be better. Protective garments, of course, such as leather gloves and batteries and the sort of things you're going to need. Think it through. Camp out one day without electricity in your house and figure out what you need and then get it. And to that earthquake kit, you can add your epidemic kit. The epidemic kit doesn't take up a lot of bulk. Go and get a box of N95 masks at your local hardware store and hang on to them. These filter virus particles. Get a box of latex gloves that fits you. In fact, get one for that fits each member of the family just so you have enough. Or get nitrile gloves if you're allergic to latex. A couple of Tyvek jumpsuits. You buy those at the hardware store too. They're used for painting, but they are impermeable. They're used in clean rooms. They keep dust particles out. They'll be pretty good for keeping body fluids off of you. And with that tucked into the gloves and a mask on, you've got your own personal protective garment. Not likely to need it, but that's one less thing to keep you awake at night. And if there is, in fact, a super flu going through and you're going to try not to catch it, your Tyvek suit, a mask, and the gloves are going to do pretty much the same. It's pretty much the same gear that the CDC is wearing this year. So it's all the rage as a fashion statement. Our next story is about Roundup. And this product has been very much in the news for the last several years. Relates to the fact that many products have been genetically engineered to be resistant to Roundup. And this includes soy, corn, cotton, alfalfa, sugar beets, things that are very, very prevalent in our food supply. And so as a result, Roundup has become effectively prevalent in our food supply. Roundup or glyphosate was it was designed to be the perfect herbicide. It blocks an enzyme that doesn't occur in animals or mammals. It's called ESPS synthase enzyme. So that was thought to be, you know, its mechanism of action. But unfortunately, like many other products or chemicals, it has more than one action. And some of the other actions of Roundup, including binding or chelating minerals and creating complexes that are damaging to the kidney. And there's a whole epidemic of kidney failure in healthy adults who are farmers in areas where there's high levels of Roundup. And unfortunately, there is emerging a larger and larger body of data that in areas where the Roundup is sprayed and therefore inhaled by people, there are cancer clusters in humans, and plenty of research looking at long-term exposure. There's now stuff published looking at 25 years of pesticide exposure, especially Roundup, and finding a link to B-cell lymphoma, a particular subtype, in fact, that is fundamentally rare, unless, of course, you happen to live in an area where they spray the crops with Roundup. There's also a linkage, and this one is much scarier because it's home, right? It's always more scary if it happens here. This is looking at children in Florida, New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania, and they found that if either parent had been exposed to Roundup at industrial levels during the 2 years before the child's birth, the chances of the child having a particularly dangerous type of cancer called glioblastoma was doubled. Now, that's a relatively rare cancer, but when you see it double, you need to pay attention. Many animal models show that Roundup damages DNA, and this has been shown in cows, eels, mice, fruit flies, and this means that it has an effect on cell division, and anything that is mutagenic is potentially a cancer causer. We have a mechanism, and we have epidemiological evidence. We need to really agitate to get this stuff pulled. Yes, it's great for the food supply. We have this wonderful, it's easy to produce more crops when you don't have to worry about weeds, but this thing is a genie out of the bottle, and it's being used in excessively high levels, and we have strong evidence that it's, we don't know it causes cancer, but we know that it mutates cells, that it damages DNA. And do we really want large quantities of that in its food supply? And I haven't even talked about the endocrine effects and the link with diabetes and the link with obesity that also have been well demonstrated in the literature. We need to get this. This needs to be a major issue, and it isn't yet. And we can separate this from GMO, which is much more complex. This just needs to stop. And we're going now to our first caller, Melinda in SoCal. Hello, Melinda, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Don. I find it interesting that I read The Guardian, which is a newspaper.
England, right?
Yes,
yes.
From the United Kingdom.
It's always interesting to get a second country's perspective, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, and it's the world issue, so, but yeah, also United Kingdom. They do have more information about, it seems, a world view as opposed to a more, United States-centric
sure.
view.
Sure, yeah, I think BBC News in general, that's the one I listen to on the radio, and I'm always surprised about, well, they're actually interested in this thing that's happening in, Nigeria, it's not England, and it's not even part of the Commonwealth, and they actually care about the world. Go ahead,
right,
please continue.
Right.
And
so one of the things that I read recently was that the WHO appointees in Africa are political appointees. So they, in the different African countries, each one has a representative of WHO.
Probably nominated by the local in-group, I'm assuming.
Well, yeah, there's a one WHO representative for the entire continent of Africa. And then I think that there's appointees for each country.
Somebody's,
and they're political appointees, apparently.
Yeah, somebody's brother-in-law, of course.
Exactly. And so not only were the three countries that are the most effective, the fact that they were all, it was all close to each other's borders, they were very reluctant to report an epidemic because of financial and political reasons, the first responses were blocked for political reasons.
You mean the people who were trying to get in to help were prevented from getting in?
Yes, the first attempts to come in, and even the first money to come in was blocked because they didn't want, because of the amount of bad publicity and the economic, you know, what they suffer economically when there's an epidemic, and with the, you know, it's, and what they're suffering now. They were, you know, so everything, part of it is, it's just a huge conundrum. And now what's going on in the United States, I think a lot of the panic in the public here is not, for me, it's not panic that I'm going to catch Ebola. It's, you know, who is running the world?
I think that you make an excellent point, and it's kind of, this is sort of the starter epidemic in the sense it's not really locally in the United States, it's not an epidemic, right? We're afraid of contagion, but in certain countries in Africa, of course, it is an, you know, a legitimate epidemic. I think 10,000 people have died, the last number I heard.
Well, they say that, yeah, they say that the numbers that we're getting out of Africa are nothing compared to what the real numbers are.
That wouldn't surprise me a bit.
No, because who can count when you're even, you can't even treat?
Exactly. Fair point. So your main point is that the foreign news media that you've been reading, that sounds kind of pejorative, excuse me, The Guardian has talked about some of the structural issues in Africa that contribute to this, and this makes you wonder what structural issues we might have here. And I would
that
say...
That we've seen already.
Yeah, and I would say that in my... I have a limited perspective, but it's a bit deeper than the average person, because I've met the county health officers, for example, over the last 25 years, and I've seen the statewide people multiple times, and I have really no concerns about the clinical competency of the people at that level. These are doctors, these are PhDs, these are people who are coming out of a scientific world. When we get to, and yes, they obviously are politically connected at the state and national levels, because it's not purely a meritocracy in Washington, in case you haven't noticed.
Right.
There's a big field of people who could perform these jobs competently, and I actually am pretty sure that up to the level of the chairman, I don't actually know about the chairman of the CDC.
Right.
Quite honestly, that is such a political role that I think they choose a person for their connections and their Rolodex, and if that's not too primitive a term, and their persona, how they project and speak and things like that.
And the hubris of people who think that they're protected because of their connections and their, you know, it just seems to me that there's so much arrogance in the proclamations that it can't happen here. We're so prepared.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Well, it's kind of what can't happen here is a widespread
epidemic,
is a widespread epidemic, because
exactly.
The things that are getting them into trouble in Africa are how do you get rid of that diarrhea?
Where does,
right. You know,
I know it can't happen here. What's happening in Africa right now, Ebola that's not going to happen here.
But we will get isolated cases coming in, and we honest to God should just kind of calm down about trying to prevent that, because
right.
we can't, and it's not practical.
And the fact that I think it shows that a lot of our hospitals aren't really very good at healthcare. I mean, I've taken people to the emergency room here and had them sent home and had to bring them back 2 hours later, almost dead.
Okay.
So I know that healthcare is not great here.
You know, I think that there's a couple problems with your statement. I'm going to argue with you just a little bit.
Okay, I know. It's very specific and anecdotal.
It's not neither of that. I mean, anecdotes have power because if something happens, then you have to look at, okay, even it's one event, it's an N of one, that doesn't mean it's not a real N, it's not a real event. And
right.
Is there something that should have been done differently, should be in any good system, whether it's a business or a healthcare our medical office, it's like, okay, that was bad. Is there anything we could have built in that would have prevented that bad thing? When you talk about people coming to the emergency room and being screened out and sent home, that's a complex dynamic, and absolutely people, that will happen, and I don't accept that that's an indication of bad health care, because things happen, right. And for, I want to give out a, this is, sounds like a digression, but I'll bring it right back, okay?
All right.
There's a guy out there in a blue pickup truck right now that I want to give a shout out to, because because 2 days ago, I was driving down Mission Street at 5 p.m., and it was, you know, typical rush hour traffic, and there was a little bit of an opening, and a guy coming in the opposite direction decided he could make a left turn, and he could, he was right, just barely. You know how it is when there's traffic, and, you know, you don't want to block the whole lane waiting for an opening, and there's an opening, I'm going to take it. Unfortunately, there was a bicyclist riding in the wrong direction up the road, crossing that street just at the moment that the guy swung his left out, and thank goodness he saw the bicyclist and hit his brakes, because otherwise there'd be a dead person.
Yeah.
What there was instead was suddenly a car laterally parked across two lanes of fast moving northbound traffic. So, of course, you slam on your brakes, and, you know, thank God I was looking, and thanks God the guy in the blue pickup truck behind me managed to stop in time to avoid, you know, pushing, creaming me, and the people behind him were stopping. And so I want to give a shout out to everyone who was there on Mission Street driving with both hands on the wheel, and kind of say, you know, it's a good thing nobody was looking at their cell phone.
Yeah.
Because that's all it would have taken, would have been one second of inattention.
And everybody would have been rear-ended.
Yeah, so hello, folks. Cell phone in the passenger seat. Don't mess with it when you're driving in traffic, and when you're driving at all, but especially, you know, when something could happen, boom, you know, like that, and people get creamed. Please,
yeah.
Cell
and
phones.
When you think you're crawling around along in traffic, you think it's okay.
You know, pull over to answer
right.
your phone is kind of the best answer. But let's go back to Ebola. Where I was taking this is just that in our circumstances of an industrial society with, you know, supposedly lots and lots of resources, we aren't careful. You know, we don't think, and even at a hospital setting, people aren't washing their hands 100% of the time.
That's why we have MRSA even out in the community now.
We're not even managing 75% of the time. And it's hard. We need, and I think, you know, maybe some kind of electronic surveillance device, like if somebody walks into the room and doesn't hit the sink on the way out of the room, that the proximity detector flashes a red light. Like,
what a good idea.
You know, little things like that. We could program this into our environment relatively cheaply if we decided to make it a priority. And this goes out to everybody, if you just never put anything in your mouth without first washing your hands before you
touch it. That's like universal precautions. That should be a part of it.
Well, this is a good time for the discussion, because we're heading into flu season.
Right.
And so my producer just flashed this up at me. Germany has set up 4 special Ebola centers, and high containment centers in certain hospitals like the NIH are a start, but every hospital essentially needs to have a plan for how it could become a containment center. Oh, in about 2 hours, you know, we're going to take, I'm going to just kind of use my own hospital because I'm familiar with it.
Right.
But we have a fairly little used space that we call 2 Central. So we're going to take 2 Central. We're going to tape this door. This is going to be, we're going to put a guard on this door. We're going to go grab a box of protective garments. No one gets in without putting this on. No one gets out without taking it off while they're inspected by the guard to make sure they do it properly.
Right.
And, you should be able to just kind of pull the trigger on that.
It's going to be a certain amount of time before that patient is transferred.
It's going to be 3:30 in the morning on a Sunday when this, you know, it's Murphy's Law. The person who maybe has Ebola in Santa Cruz, it's going to be 3:30 on Sunday morning, and there's going to be one administrator on call, And it's going to be all the second string staff, because who's there at 3 a.m? It's not the high status people.
Right.
And so it'll be the newer people, which isn't a bad thing. I'm not saying they're not completely competent, but there needs to be a plan in place in every hospital for how are we going to deal with this immediately. What's and that needs to be understood by everybody. You know, this is where the person will go. This is how the people who are on duty will care for him. And this is, you know, these are the phone numbers to call. And it just needs to be out there. And worrying about panicking, I mean, at this point, we've got people spend, you know, 24/7 on certain radio stations and certain television stations beating the panic drum.
It's
so
crazy.
If our hospitals are worried about panicking people, sorry. It's like that. If that was going to happen, it would have happened. What you need to be doing is your job, which is information and planning. And while we've done a good job with our hospital at doing that, I don't know that that's universal. And I don't actually know what the specifics of our plan are. I am confident that it exists.
I don't think we have a librarian community here. But Texas, in that particular area, they do have quite a substantial librarian community. So you would think, I mean, I know they've had a lot of criticism already. So this is, you know, after the horses get out of the barn kind of thing. And
what, we're blaming the librarians because...
No, I'm blaming the hospital.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I didn't understand.
They have a librarian community. They know about the that they have a librarian community and that there's an outbreak in Liberia. And so there may be people traveling and that because there's family.
Right. So what's your point is...
I'm just saying that the hospital should have been a little more prepared because they know they have a large librarian community.
Honest to God, I think that it's impossible to second guess this or to Monday morning quarterback it. And as far as what you were saying about, you know, sending people home, yeah, I know it's tough to be the triage nurse. Let me just go back to that.
Oh, these were two doctors.
The person,
there was nobody else in the emergency room at the time. It was early in the morning.
But I'm so not buying that. There's always the doctor doesn't do the triage.
No, but they let us in. The triage nurse let us in. This is a problem with breathing.
Oh, no. Okay, you're talking about your specific circumstances.
Yeah, my specific. Oh, we're talking about Presbyterian.
Yeah, I was just talking about being the person who's online, sitting there at the desk, and all these sick people are coming at you.
Right.
And you have to decide, you know, how sick is this person? Is this an emergency? You know, is this potentially infectious? Is this person going to keel over? And you cannot be 100% perfect in those decisions. Once it gets back to the doctor, we have criteria for admission, and they're very clear. They're very murky criteria, but there's a high bar now, particularly with the insurance, to admitting people. And there's also a high bar from the public, because I've had patients say, they admitted me to the hospital, I wasn't that sick, and I ended up with a big bill. And so you can't win. You're always going to be criticized. If you saved somebody's life, and I've had this happen, I've literally saved people's lives and had them write me a nasty letter because of the bill.
Right.
You know, it's like, dude, you'd be dead. I'm so glad that you can write me a nasty letter. But it's not possible to predict how a disease is going to go. You look at it and you kind of use years of clinical experience and what the lab tests show, and you hope you're right. And if the person gets sicker, then we tell them come back. And in this circumstance, they came back, and I presume was admitted on the second try. But we're not, you know, we're not magicians, we're not clairvoyant, and we are going to we're going to make the wrong call. If you know, think sports, you know, what do we say when someone makes the wrong call or drops the ball? We say, you know, too bad, better luck next time, learn from this experience. But we don't say you're a horrible person because you dropped the ball.
Maybe they should do video replays for doctors too.
That's not such a bad idea. If you videoed but then
so
you'd have the privacy.
Over it, like they go over their chart.
But then you'd have privacy issues on the part of the patients to contend with. So we can't do that.
They could be private videos for the doctors only and go into the charts.
No, wait.
I know.
No, the law wouldn't allow it. Anyway, thank you very much for your call. It's been an interesting discussion. And
the main point was that it's the political appointees and that a lot of this is politics.
And it's a good point. Thank you again.
Yeah. Okay, bye.
And let's go to Bruce in Elkhorn. Hello, Bruce. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Yeah, I just had two quick comments that seem to be overlooked. And one is that certainly with any disease, you want to be proactive. And the only proactive agent, it seems, out there is Doctors Without Borders, which is a nonprofit NGO that's carrying, you know, pretty much 95% of the load out in Africa. And the other side of it is that we're kind of almost unique in the U.S., it's similar to Brazil, where we actually have slums and such. So we actually have concentrations of poor people who are, you know, lack nutrition and also don't have access to medical care. So it's
I'm sorry. We're almost unique on the planet except for Brazil?
Well, in terms of if you go to Canada, for instance, you don't have the slums and ghetto areas that we have in the U.S. when you cross the border. Or you go to Europe and Germany, France, et cetera. So when you think of industrialized countries, we're kind of unique in being an industrialized country with where we still ghettoize and isolate poor people into pockets. So we're, in a sense, more vulnerable. It's just like typhus and tuberculosis that were prevalent in the tenement districts of New York, you know, where you could have a concentration. We have those similar concentrations in parts of the U.S. So if you did have Ebola, I wouldn't worry about it in Santa Cruz County, but I would worry about it in other parts of the U.S. where you could have pockets that could be easily established. So, and people that don't even have hospitals necessarily in their neighborhood, or they can get to them. So it's just, you know, it's very hit or miss in this country. So we do have places, I think, where we're vulnerable. Luckily, it's happening with African Americans. It was happening with the Mexican population. We have border towns where, frankly, you know, Juarez and other places where you have no medical care and where a pocket could get established in a heartbeat and there'd be no support to take with it. So we're kind of an anomaly in being in the Santa Cruz area or something in terms of having multiple hospitals and having everybody on staff and having a relatively healthy population.
Okay, that's a. I'm going to deconstruct that comment a little bit. That's a complex issue, of course, and you've raised several of them. Something like TB is a good place to start. Another one. Well, let's use tuberculosis. I think it's really good because if you're sitting. It's hard to get TB, but some of the more aggressive forms of TB, it probably only takes about 8 hours in the same room to get tuberculosis. And every year, many of our teachers working in the community seroconvert for tuberculosis. So we know as doctors that one of the children in their classroom has TB and has exposed them, right? So we can infer that just from the fact that this person crops up with a new onset positivity on a skin test. To the extent that tuberculosis is stimulated by crowded conditions, which it is, and lack of access to medical care, which it is, then is to the extent that which we allow slums or concentrations of poorly ventilated, crowded housing to exist in a society, we raise our risk for diseases like tuberculosis. Things someone else mentioned MRSA. There are other diseases, and you know, as we move towards a culture that, where we have the very very rich and everybody else. I think the very, very rich are sort of living under the illusion that they can live in a bubble and that it won't matter if there's a lot of disease on the outside of their bubble because they'll never be exposed to it. That's clearly a fantasy, but I actually think it's a fantasy that a lot of people who, basically are pushing a political agenda that decreases, decreases the amount of money that governments have to spend on the poor in order, you know, by let's reduce taxes yet again. No, let's do it again. No, let's double down. Didn't somebody just say
where their budget was cut by $500 million over the last 4 years?
Yeah, let's just double down on reducing. Let's just double down on reducing government spending. And that's going to, you know, somehow make the poor richer. It's not a rational mandala, and it does lead to the paradox of these pockets of the disease. Ebola is just a poster child. Ebola is the current rock star, but it's meaningless, really, in the greater scheme of things. There are much bigger problems. It simply serves to and your comments, I think, speak to those. The slums, the crowded housing, the inadequate housing, the number of homeless. This is the thing that we should be hearing about on the radio and on the television instead of Ebola. I'd like the scrutiny. I'd like, actually, I'm going to put this out to the people of Santa Cruz, because, you know, I think you guys are kind of walking around with blinders. We have the biggest homeless problem practically in the country here. And we have the one of the highest violence rates in the country here. And most of that violence, probably, I mean, I haven't seen the actual breakdown, is being perpetrated on the homeless people who are hiding in the bushes behind your house. And if we're so liberal and we're so, you know, holier than thou sometimes, and I, you know, I just kind of want to confront the community of Santa Cruz here. You know, what have you done? What have you done to help the homeless? What have you done to address this, the problem that 50% of the homeless who are here are mentally ill and have no access to any kind of health care or resources? I mean, what, you know, we've got our own, we've got our own dirty laundry to look at. So, sorry, I don't.
No, that's very apt, and I think you're to the point that we do marginalize people, and then at least maybe if they're in their self-interest, realize that they're creating sites for disease, maybe then they'll act in their own selfish self-interest to do something for these people.
Well, you know, if that's what it takes, I'd like to think that that common human decency is enough, but, it, you know, fear is good. You know, fear is obviously a great motivator.
Fear is much better.
Fear and selfishness, yep, it's working. I'll give you that. I do want to hit you with one more thing, though. There's slums all over the world. There's India has huge numbers of slums. Java, the Philippines.
Oh, no, I'm talking about industrialized countries, because you go to Canada and it's very obvious, or you go to Europe and it's very obvious you don't have what we have here.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm going to stop and read a email. This is from Donna in Santa Cruz. We are on our second child with night terrors. The first started early and had a sleep study, tonsillectomy, and acupuncture, and is now good to go. Her twin didn't start having it until 6 years old, and acupuncture is having no effect. Surgery did improve the quality of sleep and snoring, but the twin is still having problems. We take him to go to pee at night. The disruption of sleep was having the night terror effect. They've been working to try and see how they can improve their son's sleep. So one of the things that I want to emphasize is that night terrors are a self-contained problem and will do auto-regulate. They are basically they are commonly run in families, and you know, I don't like to suggest the use of drugs in this situation. Most of the time the child doesn't actually wake up. It's a bad dream that is manifesting itself, but they often will either not wake up or be amnestic for the event. It's hard on the parents. What I recommend is that you try gentle types of herbal remedies to deepen the quality of sleep, melatonin, but maybe tryptophan, but don't do anything heavier than that. Certainly don't get into sedatives. And I know it's hard, tough love kind of advice, but please ride it out, and it will pass, and probably fairly soon, given your child's age. Let's talk to Mike in Aptos. Hello, Mike. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn. Regular listener.
Go right ahead.
I had a heart attack in August at age 57 with no prior medical history of anything. And having an angioplasty and a stent in a right coronary artery, they then proceeded to prescribe several medications, including Lipitor and Plavix and some other things I can't even pronounce. I'm really disliking the side effects that I'm perceiving, and I'm wondering if there may be some alternatives. And the cardiologist mentioned that I had relatively clear arteries, and this was like a one-off blood clot. And I don't know how significant that might be, and is there any chance of getting off these medications or finding a homeopathic alternative?
Yes, absolutely. But you have to understand a little something about medical sociology. And I'm going to kind of give you the big picture view on this. Have you ever gone out to the aquarium and you've seen the school of fish swimming around, and you know how they have this amazing coordination, like the mackerel or the sardines, or even watched in the big aquarium? You know
yes,
what I'm talking about? The fish in the center of that school, that's a game. Who can stay? You know, I want to be in the center because I am the safest in the center. I won't get eaten, by the sharks or by the predators. And so part of that beautiful thing you see is all of those fish maneuvering instinctually to be in the center of the block of fish. And the smartest fish is always the one in the center. If you take the predator to be lawsuits and being blamed for something going wrong, then being in the center of the school is the safest place. And if you're a cardiologist, that means recommending and attempting to enforce these guidelines for management of people who have had a heart attack. And these rules of management are based on large-scale studies of people with quote-unquote coronary artery disease. And by definition, you have coronary artery disease because you have had a blood clot in a coronary artery. And the presumption is that you have at least some plaque in the place where you had your blood clot. And the plaque can be as little as just a 10% little skin. It isn't even really affecting the flow of blood under ordinary circumstances, and it's completely impossible to see it. This is really key to people. I can do an angiogram on you, and there might be no visible plaque at all, because seeing the difference between a 100% open artery and a 90% open artery, if the plaque is almost, it's just impossible. We don't have the level of resolution. We could do some kind of invasive study, like send an ultrasound probe into your coronary artery, but I wouldn't recommend that as a screening procedure, because that's pretty dangerous. But when we do that, we find that people who have had one of these, like you had, have a lot of low-grade plaque throughout their arteries. Now, that means you have to behave as if you actually have plaque. What that means is that you want to have an anti-inflammatory diet. And if you're going to try to do this the natural way and not use a statin, which is going against the recommendations, and you're on your own, your cardiologist is not going to tell you it's okay. He can't, and or she can't and won't. But you can look at if we look at the data, we can see one study. There are very few studies that compare natural remedies to drugs, because you can't get them funded. The drug company certainly isn't going to fund them. And the NIH, which, come to think of it, the person who makes those funding decisions is a political appointee. Somehow those political appointees have decided not to spend the alternative money actually going after big pharma. They're not studying head-to-head, you know, does quercetin work as well as Allegra? You won't see the United States government funding that study either. But so back to plaque. There is one study someone did using high-dose fish oil and Lipitor in patients who had had heart attacks, which is your group, and they found exactly the same outcome, Lipitor versus high-dose omega-3 fatty acids. That's one study. We like to see replication. I've already mentioned why there probably won't be a lot of replicating studies here. But I found that a very persuasive study. So people who have, so people like yourself who are, you're at high risk for another heart attack, because you've probably got plaque in other locations, which could crack. So the anti-inflammatory diet's important. Getting your insulin levels low, which means getting your hemoglobin A1C low, is important, because if you get your, if you lose your belly fat, you get your hemoglobin A1C lows. That means that your insulin's low. That means that your PAI is low. PAI is platelet activating factor. And if you can get that low, then you're not going to be as likely to clot. So when you get a little crack across a piece of plaque, you're not going to have all those platelets jumping on there like a football pileup and blocking the flow of blood. Instead, what will happen is the platelets will jump on, and they'll be slow and sluggish and not terribly sticky, and they'll get blown away by the flow of blood, so you won't accumulate a blockage. And that's how the use of blood thinners works. That's why aspirin reduces heart attacks. It's because the plaque still cracks, but the actual normal mechanisms of healing eventually pave it over, and there isn't, during that critical moment when it could turn into a big clot and block the artery, the balance of clotting versus non-clotting is in favor of flow, and so flow continues. And omega-3 fatty acids also have a positive effect on the platelets, in the sense that they inhibit platelets. So they act kind of in an aspirin-like way, which is why they're good for pain in general. So high-dose anti-inflammatories, like omega-3 fatty acids, you need to lower your cholesterol from whatever it is.
It's under 150.
But you don't want to get it below their total cholesterol below 130, because that's going to start, then you won't have hormones to make, you won't have enough cholesterol to make hormones or cell walls, and that has a negative effect on you. And there's no proof that getting the total cholesterol down below 150 does any additional advantage. And, you know, the side effects that you mentioned for statins, I do want to just throw this out. A lot of times, if you take high-dose CoQ10, you can mitigate a lot of the side effects. That has to do with the fact that statins reduce your CoQ10 levels, which is both an enzyme and coenzyme, and a factor that's present in every single mitochondria in your body.
So, in other words, I have to take another drug to counteract the first drug.
No, you have to take a supplement, because your drug stopped you from making it yourself. You won't.
What do you consider a high dose of the omega-3s?
4,000 milligrams of EPA.
I'm currently taking three. I'll up that.
Yeah, 4,000, probably at least 2,000 milligrams of EPA plus DHA. That was what they used in the study, and I would basically take lots of fish oil until my gums bleed, and then back off a little.
And do you prefer? Are there? I have heard that there are differences in fish oil versus something like a Costco versus another brand, a boutique brand of some sort.
Well,
what's your opinion on that?
I look at the EPA and DHA content as my guide. The cheaper the brand, the lower the EPA and DHA. And so you want that high. There's reason to believe that the triglyceride form is better than the ester form. So if you're going in your situation, if I was going to rely on fish oil to prevent my heart attack and forego the standard medical routine advice of taking a statin, I would be taking the top quality fish oil. I'm not bargain hunt here, and lots of it. And as I said, low carbohydrate, low inflammatory diet, lots of fruits and vegetables, exercise. You've got the stents, so you take the Plavix for at least a year while that thing is re-epithelializing.
Okay.
You are going off the track. I can't tell you that that's okay. I don't know that that's okay, but certainly there is research to suggest that high dose fish oil is as good as Lipitor, and that was in a good clinical trial of people like you. So I don't think you're completely going off, you know, into la la land here.
I heard anecdotally that
We're going to have to leave it here, but that memory effect is related to the CoQ10. So maybe 300 milligrams of good quality CoQ10 there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. It's been an interesting walk from Ebola to the inside of the arteries. And as usual, we'll be back next week with more of your questions and calls. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.